Okay. Is it all right if we sit? Can I sit? Is that all right? Or I might get up. I might move around. But for now, anyway. And should I use? Is it preferred that I use the microphone? Okay, I'll use the microphone. Okay.
So first of all, Rabbi Jen, I think you sold yourself a little bit short. You didn't listen in on a Talmud study group. You were part and parcel of that Talmud study group. I think we learned the 8th chapter of Bava Metzia. Good. It was a small group. I think it was like 4 or 5, and Rabbi Jen was one of those 4 or 5, and it was great fun. It was in one of the lounges on North Campus.
What kind of a grade did you get?
It was not for credit. It was completely extracurricular. So, this is, I'm going to make an admission here. This is the first time I've ever spoken in a Reform temple. It's the first time I've ever addressed a Reform congregation. It might be. I'm not sure. It might be. I'm not sure. I don't think it is, but...
I'll take my horns off right now.
I know. So I'm happy to be here. And the truth of the matter is, I think that it's, Rabbi Jen was my student. I won't say exactly how long ago, but it was a while ago. The fact that we still keep in touch. The fact that she will still consider me her teacher, and I'll still consider her my student. I think that's why I'm here today. That's what got me here today, and I think it's my colleagues might look at me and say why are you going there? And I would say, listen, I have a student that's a rabbi there. I'm proud of that. I'm proud of her. So hey. Nothing more than that. Nothing more or less. So if I seem a little bit out of my comfort zone, it's because I am. And the truth of the matter is that some of the things that I'm going to say, this is one of those warning things. It might take you out of your comfort zone. What do they call those warnings? Those
disclaimers.
No, I mean like in social media, like a
trigger warning.
Thank you. I'm going to try to, it could be, the truth of the matter is, I hope that we're all going to leave our comfort zones a little bit today and think about things and talk about things in a way that sort of forces us to confront things in a particular way. You can, as you imagine, I affiliate with Orthodoxy. I would imagine that everybody here affiliates with the Reform movement. My goal here is not to criticize either of those groups. Even if there's criticism of individuals, I'm going to assume the overall dignity of each group, the internal dignity of everyone. Before getting to what I do, and I'm a criminal, right? I perform weddings outside outside of the Israeli chief rabbinate, which is illegal in Israel. Before talking about why I do that, I'm going to give a little bit more of a detail about what it is that I do. It's something that I've done about a dozen times. And we'll start with some historical background. In 1947, there was an important document signed by David Ben-Gurion, who was soon to be the first prime minister of the state of Israel. It was a concession. Four concessions. At the time, the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine was visiting, and Ben-Gurion wanted to make sure that the most religious elements, right, the most religious elements who hadn't really joined the Zionist movement, that they would be on board, that they wouldn't say to the British, we would rather, you know, they wouldn't say to this special commission, we would prefer if the British are in charge, we don't want the Zionists to be in charge. So in order to do that, he gave them four concessions, but they were concessions in the sense that, I mean, they were the agreement is called the status quo agreement, which implies that everything had already been in place beforehand, but he agreed to continue those four things. One element of the agreement is that there would be kosher food in all national establishments. He did not agree that there would be exclusively kosher food, but that there would be kosher food. Every government building, every ministry, every public school, every everything would have kosher food available. The second was that Saturday would be the national day of rest, meaning, like the rest of the Western world, Israel operates on a seven-day work week. The same way that in most Christian countries, even if there's no official Christianity, that day is Sunday. In the state of Israel, or in the Jewish state, that day would be Shabbat. That day would be Saturday. Okay, and without any details, there was no buses will run on Shabbat, or these buses won't run on Shabbat. It was just, that would be the national day of rest. The third one was that there would be educational autonomy for religious communities. Religious communities would be able to educate their children by their own lights. Again, it didn't agree that they don't have to have any secular subjects. It didn't agree that you can build whatever school you want and we will fund it carte blanche no matter what. But they would not be compelled to go to state educational institutions. All three of those are non-coercive, right? They all say, "This is something that this is something that we're going to have. This is something that we're going to make available. This is something that we're going to allow you to do." But it doesn't say this is something that everybody has to do. Now we come to the fourth element. The fourth element that of this agreement was that marriage and divorce would be under the exclusive control of the rabbinic authorities. Everyone who gets married in the future state of Israel, or every Jew that gets married in the future state of Israel, would be required to get married through what became known as the Israeli chief rabbinate, through the rabbinic establishment. And whether or not such a person would want to get married there, whether or not such a person wants to get married with a different ceremony, with a different, an intermarriage between a Jew and a non-Jew, it was illegal. It was rendered illegal, right? And it was agreed upon by Ben-Gurion that it was rendered illegal. So I'm sure we're all aware that to this day there's no civil marriage in Israel. Every person belongs to a religious community in Israel, meaning there are 17 recognized religious communities, religious establishments, Baha'i, Druze, Sunni Islam, not Shia Islam, Judaism is one, and you might be thinking, no, not Judaism is one. Orthodox Judaism is one. We're going to come back to that. We're going to circle back to that. But for now, we can say, okay, I'll agree with that. I'll agree with that. Orthodox Judaism is one.
If you're Muslim, you can get married in Israel?
Of course. There are recognized Sharia courts in Israel. Muslims get married under the Muslim equivalent of the Rabbanut, and there are, I think, 13 different Christian denominations that are recognized. Okay, mostly non-Protestant, But I think there are one or two Protestant denominations as well. I don't know the list. It's a lot. Maronite and Circassian and all kinds. Okay. There have been several attempts in Israel's history to undermine the status quo and repeal that, specifically that element of the status quo. In other words, to allow for civil marriage in Israel. They've all been unsuccessful and probably will remain so for the time, you know, for the foreseeable future. I don't see a political constellation that would repeal that and enable civil marriage. And I should also point out that even, you know, so-called liberal orthodoxy accepts this state of affairs. There are crusaders in Israel for a more lenient orthodox approach within the chief rabbinate. And in their worldview, these liberal orthodox organizations think that a kinder, gentler rabbinate would be to everybody's liking. Everybody will be happy if there's a kinder, gentler rabbinate. It's what I call a nanny theocracy. Their view of non-Orthodox movements is that really the only reason that there are non-Orthodox movements in Israel is because, you know, as an act of rebellion, because people feel disdain for the religious establishment. But if we were to take over the religious establishment, we're such nice guys that, you know, that'll just fall away and we'll cease to exist here. Needless to say, I doubt very, very, very many people in this room agree with it, and I'm included in that. I don't think they're right.
Explain to us both points of view. There's got to be a negative, and they're positive. Explain the negative as well.
The negative, meaning oh, why? Why? Point of view. What's the point of view that sees that's in favor of this concentrated uniform rabbinic establishment?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So it's my belief that it may have been necessary at the founding of the State of Israel. David Ben-Gurion, and I'm basing myself here on the writings of a professor of political science at Syracuse University named Yuxel Sezgin, something like that. He, I believe himself, is Turkish, and he studied... that was funny. He studied Ottoman law, and he studied Judaism under Ottoman regimes, and he's written about how that Ottoman, when we talk about the status quo, this state of affairs really starts under the Ottoman regime, pre-World War I. He makes a case that Ben-Gurion wanted to preserve the status quo not only as a concession, meaning he makes the case that one of Ben-Gurion's guiding philosophies was what's called mamlachtiyut, which is very hard to translate, but it means something like state-centeredness or state consciousness. It's not statism or etatism as we think of it today, but what it is that he saw that in the early years of the states, you had Jews coming in from all over the world. You had Jews coming in from Iraq and from Yemen and from Morocco, and you had Jews coming in from Hungary and Romania, and you had Jews coming in from Poland and Russia, and they were all coming together, and he said, and everybody, and all of these different groups, they had their own communal consciousness, they had their own tribal consciousness, whether it's Ashkenazi or Sephardi or everything in between, or, you know, like even Ashkenazi and Sephardi are also their catch-all terms. There's a tremendous amount of variety even within those terms. So he wanted to make sure that there would be that people wouldn't have allegiance to their tribal or ethnic groups first and only to the Jewish state second. He wanted to make sure that people were conscious of their relationship with the state first, right? That the state would be their community. the state would be a sort of uber community for all Jews coming into the state of Israel. And the truth of the matter is, the structure of the rabbinate, it wasn't different in kind from, let's say, the rabbinic establishment or the way that affairs were governed in Bialystok or Chernovitz. There was, people did what they did, and there were all kinds of Jews there, and they were into all kinds of political movements or whatever. But when it came to things like kashrut and things like, ritual slaughter and performing weddings and funerals and circumcisions, it was concentrated in the hands of the local rabbinate. Except that now Ben-Gurion was taking that structure and imposing it not on the local 30 or 40,000 Jews, but imposing it on a state of 600,000 Jews, which has now grown to a state that has, as in its citizenship, 6 million Jews. So the structure was there, but the structure was not ready to govern that sort of, or whether it is or isn't, that sort of, that skips some steps, but it's now governing a population that's far greater than it was ever imagined that it would have to govern. So that's the view. That's the view. Okay. Now Mamlachtiyut lives on. I'm going to add another ingredient to that. In 1921, with the establishment of the chief rabbinate as part of the British Mandate. The first chief rabbi, Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi, he gave a speech in which he outlined the vision of the rabbinate. He envisioned it as an apolitical body that would be a conduit for the restoration of God's sovereignty on earth. Okay? Now, there's a very, very difficult, one of the challenges of Zionism in general is that Jewish yearning, Jewish longing for return to the land of Israel over the course of, since the second temple was destroyed in the first century of the Common Era, there were all kinds of valences there. There was one question of a physical return. One was a question of restoration of Jewish sovereignty. A third one is the restoration of God's sovereignty or the sovereignty of God's law. Three times a day in the prayer book that's used by Orthodox Jews to this day, and in the which was the prayer book quotes Isaiah or paraphrases the first chapter of Isaiah, Ve'ashiva shoftayach kivarishona, Ve'yoatzayach kivatchila. I will restore your magistrates as of old and your advisors as of yore, and then you will be called, you Jerusalem will be called, the city of justice, the trusted town, and Zion b'mishpat tipadeh, it concludes the chapter, Zion will be redeemed with justice, and its returnees will be redeemed with staka through righteousness, right? And this is part and parcel of Isaiah's vision, and that's paraphrased in the daily Amidah, the daily prayer service. So it's very hard to tease apart, right? There are some people that it's very hard to tease apart those longings and that belief from. When Zionism becomes a reality, when the state of Israel becomes a reality, these are expectations that have lied dormant for a very, very long time. So it's
what was the practical end? What was the practical end?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. So it was, and today there's a third ingredient. So it's three ingredients. One, this is something that Ben-Gurion wanted. Ben-Gurion wanted to concentrate, wanted to give power to the rabbis, so that there would be a certain uniformity in terms of the Jewish, so he could transform these disparate communities into a single Israeli Jewish people. Number two is that part of the longings, part of the yearnings that that Jews have had since time immemorial was that the return to the land of Israel would be accompanied by a restoration of the sovereignty of Jewish law.
And a third part, and you know, this is probably the most difficult nut to crack today, the third part is money, political patronage. And today, I mean, it's a big industry, right? It's an arm of government. There are allocations for it. And control of that, by whichever party controls it, means that they can appoint their people to the jobs, and you know, there's good money in it, so they don't want to give that up. You know what? I can even add a fourth element, which is that people are afraid. There's like a certain fear, and this, I think it's, I think the fear is real, but I'm not sure that the fear is rational. The fear that unless there's some gatekeeper to patrol the boundaries of the Jewish people, everything will fall apart. So there needs to be a gatekeeper, because they look around at what's going on in the diaspora with intermarriage and with you know, and with you know, Jewish identity weakening with each successive generation, and they say, you know what, we don't want those problems here, you know, so we need to man the ramparts. I don't think that's a real fear. Put it this way. I don't think it's a rational fear, but I think it is a real fear. And a lot of people will talk to that, and because it's not a rational fear, it's difficult to talk about it rationally with them. Okay. The problems with this state of affairs, right? The problems with the state of affairs today, the present state of affairs. And this is probably not news to many of you. Number one is that, you know, something that was designed for a smaller group of people is now administering to 6 million people. Regulations are impersonal. Standardization doesn't allow for, by definition, doesn't allow for individuation. And there are so many of these questions, right? The Jewish legal literature, the Jewish responsal literature, is filled with questions that are, you know, that are all, they're marginal questions. They're questions of you know, that appear in liminal spaces, right? Is this okay? Is this not okay? Right? Is a person that's in this particular situation, can there be an exception? And when you have a bureaucracy that's designed to, when you have a giant bureaucracy, there's very little room to maneuver, because it works like a government bureaucracy. And there's, you know, try going to the DMV and explaining to them that you had a bad day on the day that you took the driving test, right? They're not going to be interested, right? Because it's a bureaucracy, because bureaucracies are not designed to deal with those, with the individual cases. They're not good at dealing with exceptions. Jewish law historically has been very good at dealing with exceptions. But when you take a Jewish legal establishment and transform it into a government bureaucracy, it loses that maneuverability. It loses that nimbleness. A second problem, and this is because of its a result of its politicization, is you have nepotism. Both chief rabbis today are sons of former chief rabbis. That's not a coincidence. That can't be a coincidence, right? And then it's at the top level. It happens to be that I have a great deal of respect for both. For both present-day chief rabbis. I think they're both wonderful people. The problem is when you really get into the mid and lower level bureaucrats. There's this one fellow, I don't know how he got his job, right? He's about my age. He's in charge of determining the Jewish status for the purposes of marriage of every Israeli Jew born outside the state of Israel. He has to get the documentation and he has to evaluate it. He only speaks Hebrew. He speaks no other language, not Russian, not English, not Spanish, not French. This is where people are coming to Israel from. He speaks none of those languages. He knows nothing about those communities. I had a conversation with Rabbi Lau. He lives in Modi'in. I live in Modi'in. We met on the street one Shabbat. We started talking. I said, how does that guy still have a job? He was telling me about all these grandiose plans, documentation. He has negotiations going on with Ukraine and Poland and Russia. And, you know, it's all going to be available and online. And it's going to be so much easier. I was like, yeah, but this guy still has to make the call. And he's still got his job. He's like, yeah, I can't get rid of that guy. Because he's not one of my appointees. He's one of the other guy's appointees. right? So, you know, and everything is based on this negotiation. Okay, you get to appoint this one, you get to appoint that one. So it's just, it becomes Kafkaesque. And now, I'm sure you're aware that a former chief rabbi of the state of Israel is going to prison for selling conversions. Right? Yonah Metzger. He sold conversions. You pay him enough money. What? Conversions to Judaism. He was selling, you know, if you have to go through the system, unless you could pay him, you know, a certain amount of money under the table. He's going for tax evasion also, obviously, because he wasn't declaring this as income. And he's going to jail because, you know, this sort of thing invites corruption. It's an unfortunate reality. Okay? What?
I say it's true of every country.
It's true of every country, but it hurts more. Look, I'm a rabbi. It hurts more to see it happening with a rabbi, right? If somebody is, you know, there's corruption at all levels of government, in every government in the world, and to a certain extent, it's the cost of doing business. You know, and there's a certain amount that we stomach because, you know, it greases the wheels of the machine. But, you know, when somebody is allegedly a man of God, I mean, this is the sort of thing that led to the Protestant Revolution, right? The sale of indulgences. So it's particularly painful. And the final problem, and this one is, I feel this one probably most acutely, is that it over-politicizes religion, meaning this, I would say, entanglement of religion and state, right? All the reasons that I've said until now are problems of state. It's also a problem of religion, right? It turns religion, right? It turns, first of all, there are multiple worldviews that are in a tug of war over the religious establishment. To the spoils go the victor, right? You're running political campaigns on this is my view of religion, this is my view of religion. And I think it hurts. It hurts Judaism, right? I think the state will be fine. I think that the fact that this is the face of Judaism for the state of Israel and to a large degree for the world, you know, I think that's a terrible thing. You know, that Judaism itself has been reduced to the level of the DMV. And the debate is about, can we make the DMV, can we make the Department of Motor Vehicles, can we make the post office function more smoothly? Yeah, we probably can make the post office function more smoothly. But it's still the post office. And I don't want Judaism to be the post office. I think it has a lot more to offer than that. So, with all that in mind, I perform illegal weddings. The law on the books is that there's a penalty of prison for up to 2 years for the bride and the groom and the rabbi who officiates at a wedding that is not registered with the Israeli chief rabbinate. In this case, it's funny. Because I have ordination from the Israeli chief rabbinate, I qualify in their eyes as a rabbi, so I can go to jail. Interestingly enough, if Rabbi Jen were to perform such a wedding, she probably wouldn't be able to go to jail because the establishment there doesn't recognize her as a rabbi. So the travesty of that turns into keeps her out of jail. But the truth of the matter is that I don't think I'm going to go to jail either. In fact, I'm pretty certain that I'm not going to go to jail because I think they realize it's a silly law, and I think they realize that it makes no sense to throw somebody into jail. And if they do throw somebody into jail, it'll turn that person into a martyr. And I don't think they want to do that. I don't think they want to give the anti-rabbinate cause, you know, someone to rally around. Yeah, I hope. I mean, it's not just that I hope. I'm banking on it. I keep doing it because I have zero fear of being arrested for it. Yeah.
How do these people that are married by you or some other rabbi who's stepping outside the pale,
How do they ensure that they have the rights that are enshrined in marriage? How is, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. One of two ways. One is, and I insist that they go through one of these two ways. I'm not interested in people marrying off the books. Interestingly enough, most marriages like this that take place are the sorts of marriages like it's a second marriage and, you know, either the bride or the groom doesn't want to lose various benefits that they're getting from their former or deceased spouse, social, whatever, pensions benefits and the like. So they get married off the books, off the grid, don't register it anywhere so that they don't have to give up those rights. I won't do, and by the way, and very few people have a problem with that. It happens all the time, right? They only have problem with people who will do these illegal weddings on principle. Go figure. So I do it on principle. I actually would not officiate one of those weddings, but the way that they register the wedding, and I insist on one of these two ways, is either they sign a very detailed prenup that outline all of the rights and duties and expectations within this domestic relationship, because it wouldn't be called a marriage, and it's registered with the Ministry of the Interior as what's called a yiduim batzibur, as a common law marriage. Okay, that's one possibility. The second possibility is that they would get married civilly abroad. Israel recognizes marriages performed outside the state of Israel, including intermarriages, including same-sex marriages, all of them. You know, any marriage that's sanctioned by a foreign government, that's performed under that foreign government, the state of Israel will recognize. You just can't do it in Israel. So I insist on one of those two. I prefer the common law because in the case of, if it's a civil marriage abroad, because it's defined as marriage, if the couple wants to divorce, they have to go to the rabbinate. Meaning even such marriages abroad have to go through the rabbinate. Okay? But because I don't think there's really a risk of arrest, but because theoretically there's a theoretical risk of arrest, every couple that I meet with, I tell them, you should know what we're doing is illegal. There is a theoretical risk of arrest. And I promise that if the three of us are going to be arrested, I will make a special, I will beg that the two of you have your own cell because I don't want to intrude on your honeymoon. Okay? I don't want to intrude on their honeymoon. Okay? So, why do these, so first of all, what sort of couple comes to me? So sometimes it's couples, one of the couples is a convert to Judaism, and their conversion isn't recognized by the chief rabbinate. Sometimes it's someone who's Jewish, but their Jewishness is not documented. They come from a country where records weren't kept well. And sometimes it's just a statement of protest, a statement of, I want nothing to do with the rabbinate. Those are more often than not. That's the most frequent case that I get. And sometimes it's a combination. But I will say that I always reserve the right to say no. I'm an Orthodox rabbi. There are marriages that I will not officiate at. There are marriages that I don't feel comfortable doing this. I don't think that such a marriage would be, correct in my understanding of Jewish law. So I reserve the right to do that, meaning, and I say that I respect your opinion, I respect your view, but I'm asking you to respect mine and that this is not something that I'm comfortable performing, and sometimes I'll send them elsewhere. I'll also be very upfront about what Orthodox marriage entails or what chupa v'kiddushin Kedat Moshe Yisrael entails, right? The halachic wedding ceremony, as codified in Shulchan Aruch and Jewish codes, which is still practiced in throughout the Jewish world, throughout large parts of the Jewish world. And I'll tell them what my red lines are. I'll tell them what I'm willing to do, what I'm not willing to do, and If they want to stick with me, they'll stick with me. If they don't, they'll find someone else. And it's their choice. And I think that's the key point. The key point is it's their choice. They have a choice. I have a choice. They have a choice. We come together. I officiate at their weddings as a matter of choice for both of us. So why do I do it? Why do I agree to do it? For me, it's a way of putting pressure on... It's a way of putting pressure on the system. I want systemic change. Meaning I don't want the sort of... I don't want to improve the DMV sort of change. I want a systemic type of change. And I'll say I'm not against the Rabbanut. I'm not against the Israeli chief rabbinate. I actually think that they're functioning exactly as they're intended to function. My problem is with the way that they're intended to function. My problem is with the laws that grant them the power to function in the way that they function. I have no problem with rabbis issuing rulings and making decisions based on what they believe to be correct and what they believe to be the proper interpretation of Judaism. I do have a problem with a state mandate to impose that view. So my problem is with the government, with the legislation that empowers rabbis, for all intents and purposes, gives them guns. I think that rabbis and guns are a bad combination, meaning rabbis and power are a bad combination. But it's not with the rabbis themselves. They're operating as best as they can in a system that, because of the political realities, the system is very hard to change. What do I think can change the system? I think that the system can change when we free our minds, or when Israelis free their minds. In recent cases, you probably would have seen that, you know, let's say somebody's conversion wasn't recognized. And so they beg the Rabbanut and they appeal the Rabbanut, recognize me as Jewish, everybody recognizes me as Jewish, the rabbis who converted me, they're great, they're wonderful rabbis. So please, 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 Chief Rabbinate, recognize me as Jewish. And my perspective is, wait, you're Jewish. Why do you seek the validation of a bureaucracy? Now, I have no claims on the people who do seek that validation. You're talking about people who converted to Judaism. They're, by definition, they're vulnerable. By definition, they always, a convert, we have a special mitzvah, we have a special obligation to include converts within the community, to make sure that converts are not marginalized, to make sure that converts are not made to feel like second-class citizens, right? So to say to the convert, it's not fair for born Jews to say to converts, yeah, well, you know, don't worry about the Rabbanut. It's okay if the Rabbanut doesn't recognize you. We can, you know, we still recognize you. That should be good enough for you. No, that's not good enough, because that person will still feel that anxiety and that identity crisis wherein the Israeli chief rabbinate doesn't recognize me as a Jew. What I think we need to do is that the people whose Judaism is not in question or does not need to be documented need to say, you know what, I'm also getting married outside the Israeli chief rabbinate. And therefore, when somebody who's getting married, who because of whatever reason can't get married or has trouble getting recognized with the Israeli chief rabbinate, you can say, hey, I also didn't get married to the Israeli chief rabbinate. It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Who are they? It's a bunch of beards and suits. Okay? So I think it's important as a way of protecting the most vulnerable elements of the Jewish people. Okay. Now we're going to get to the somewhat uncomfortable part. I'm going to send out this... Can we pass this out? Here. You want to pass those out, sir?
Okay, the document coming around, I'll talk a little bit about it before, you know, before we read it. I see that not everybody has a sheet yet. The document coming around is a responsum, right? It's a question that was asked to a rabbi or a group of rabbis. And that's actually what I study. When I'm studying, you know, modern Hungarian responsa. This one is not Hungarian. It's American, and it's from the CCAR, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the umbrella body for the Reform Rabbinate in the United States and Canada. So the question that was asked to them was sort of what I described a few minutes ago. A retired heterosexual couple has approached me to perform a commitment ceremony for them in lieu of a wedding, since they have a wish to avoid losing Social Security benefits but still want to have a ceremony affirming their mutual love and commitment. They want to know if that's permissible, if it's permissible to do that. And they want to use as precedent the responsum, the reform responsum, that permitting gay and lesbian commitment ceremonies. So the answer that came down from the CCAR was no. You cannot officiate it. You may not officiate at such a wedding. And they gave two reasons. The first reason is basically that it's unethical, right? It's completely unethical, right? And on that point, I think we're all in agreement. Fine. There's a second point that he makes. There's a second point that they make. And this is the one that interests me more for our purposes. So they're quoting a 1974 responsum from Rabbi Solomon Freehoff, who was probably the leading reform halachic scholar in his generation. And his works are enlightening and masterful and phenomenal. And he, you know, he's written books on responsa, which are outstanding. So they're citing his responsum. They say he also notes that it may well be a violation of state law for a clergy person to officiate at a wedding where no license has been issued. It's illegal for a clergy person. It may be illegal for a clergy person to officiate a wedding where no state license has been issued. The legal prohibition is also valid under the principle of dina de malchuta dina. The law of the land is the law. For the state has a legitimate interest in regulating the monetary and familial aspects of marriage, ownership of property, issues of inheritance, child custody, and the like. Therefore, the state may legitimately require a couple to register their marriage with the proper authorities, and we rabbis would be expected under Jewish law to honor this requirement. And so the question that I pose to you is, if I were to ask the CCAR whether or not I'm permitted to do what I do, what would the answer be? That would be illegal, because dina de malchuta dina, if the state law, under the principle of dina de malchuta dina as interpreted by Rabbi Freehoff, if the state law in Israel is you must get married under the Israeli chief rabbinate, right? And failure to do so is illegal. And any ceremony that isn't registered with the rabbinate is illegal. Is against state law. So Rabbi Freehoff might conclude that it's illegal, that a rabbi, a reform rabbi in Israel, should not conduct such a ceremony. Now, there is an exception. I talked with Rabbi Jen and Rabbi Ariano beforehand. There is an exception for if the law itself is deemed to be unethical, right? If the law itself is deemed to be unjust, right? So that may be an out here. So the Reform rabbi may be able to do that. But I'm using this as a segue to the next. You know, what I want to talk about we still have about 15 minutes. And that's the question of,
And I'm not going to talk about Reform and Orthodox. I'm going to talk about Israel and the United States. Israeli Jews and American Jews, and by Israeli Jews I mean pretty much all Israeli Jews, whatever their beliefs and whatever their affiliations, and all American Jews of whatever denomination, they conceive of Judaism in vastly different ways. They think about Judaism in vastly different ways. Judaism is a very different thing through the eyes of each, and each one looks at the other through the lens of their own Judaism. Okay? So the position here, the position that's taken here in this responsum, goes back to 1843. It goes back to Rabbi Samuel Holdheim, one of the founding fathers of the Reform movement, and he was one of the first. He represented what was called then radical reform, meaning he really wanted to make deep systemic changes to Judaism. And one of the things that he said is that there's really no reason to have a Jewish marriage ceremony. He wanted to completely do away with the Jewish marriage ceremony. He said, we don't need a Jewish marriage ceremony. The civil marriage ceremony, civil divorce ceremony, those are good enough for us, because essentially it's a, meaning he wanted to get rid of any sort of vestige of Jewish self-government, right? Any sort of expression of the idea of Jewish self-government, of Jewish legal autonomy, to him was his conception of Judaism, or the conception of Judaism that he was trying to promote, was against that. Essentially, what he was trying to do, and he wasn't the only one, there are others that were trying to do this also, and there were Orthodox rabbis who were doing this also, he was trying to transform Judaism into a religion. Into a religion in the sense that we talk about religion today. The sense of religion which is fundamentally Protestant, fundamentally developed in Germany in the 17th and 18th centuries, and fundamentally individual, personal. Okay? Religion is something that happens in my personal life. Religion is something that happens at a place of worship. Religion is not something that happens beyond that. Now, Holdheim's view, I think that there are religious ceremonies that all rabbis of all denominations perform today. Even though it's still on the books, and this footnote over here is, it points out that Rabbi Friedhof is sort of undermining Rabbi Holdheim's view of that, and that the CCAR considers that we may want to revisit that. He says, the last line, this may eventually lead us to reopen the matter of a Reform get. A get is a bill of Jewish divorce that the Reform movement still maintains to this day, that it's not an absolute requirement in order to terminate a Jewish marriage. So meaning that a civil divorce is, obviates the need for a get, obviates the need for a religiously, a document that's issued by a religious body. So that's part of this sort of divestment, this disconnection between what came to be called religion and other trappings of autonomy and other trappings of law. Okay? It's individual. Religion is individual. It may be ritual, but it's about belief. And it views Judaism through that lens of religion. Especially in the United States, particularly in the United States, there's this idea that belief and action, belief and behavior should be in harmony. This goes back to the days of the Puritans here in America. If I dissented from what the church elders were telling me, if there was something that they were telling me that I couldn't believe, or an instruction that they gave me that I couldn't follow, then I was freed. I left that church. I went over to the next town. I put up a shingle and I said, okay, I've got my own church now. Right? That was part and parcel of the American experience. That was part and parcel of why the Puritans came to this country in the first place, and that it has a lasting impression on how Americans view religion. And I think that it's how American Jews, and even American Orthodox Jews, by and large, view Judaism. And I think that this is something that the relationship between Israeli and American Judaism really turns on this, to a large degree on this issue. And I think it's important that we have to, you know, that we try to understand each other. Meaning, I grew up in America, so it's easier for me to understand the American mindset, but it's very hard for Israelis to understand this American mindset. And I think it's equally true of Americans and Israelis. It's very difficult for Americans to sort of get into the heads of what Israelis think about religion. I'll give you an example, and this is something that we started with. I made reference to it before. I often read in the media that complaints, charges, that there is an Orthodox monopoly on Judaism in Israel. And from an American perspective, there is an Orthodox monopoly on Judaism in Israel. My question is, from an Israeli perspective, is there an Orthodox monopoly on Judaism in Israel? First of all, I don't think it's a monopoly. I think it's a very tight cartel, but that's neither here nor there, right? We can call it a monopoly. It has all of the trappings of monopoly. The question is really, is it Orthodox? The overwhelming majority of Israeli Jews originated in countries where the dominant religion was Islam, or an Eastern Orthodox Christian church, or Catholic churches, right? Poland and Romania were Catholic. Russia, Belarus, Ukraine were Orthodox. And Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, those were all Islamic. And those are the main sources on Yemen. Those are the main sources of Jewish immigration to Israel. Those have, historically, that's where most Israeli Jews are from. Not from Protestant countries, not from countries that ever had a Reform Jewish movement, right? And I think the two are, that's synonymous, right? The only countries that ever had a very strong, robust, not just Reform movement, but any sort of denominational split, were only countries with where there was some sort of Protestant ethos, right? Mainly Germany, the United States, Canada, and to a lesser degree, and it deserves a study of its own, the Hungarian part of Austria-Hungary, okay, where the Neolog movement it was the largest non-Orthodox movement in Judaism in the years leading up to World War I with about 1 million adherents. Okay. For those, right, for Jews in these countries, as for Jews in other countries, meaning even in, even in Germany before the modern era, Judaism itself was this sort of like this tight, it was this web that includes religion and it includes culture and it includes peoplehood and nationality and ethnicity, right, that was indivisible. Right, it couldn't be divided. It was because you lived in a community, an autonomous community, where all of those elements were interconnected. Right, it's only in the modern era that we can sort of divide. We can cut the Gordian knot of religion and ethnicity and culture and nationality. It's the term Orthodox refers specifically to the reaction against the cutting of that Gordian knot. Right. The Orthodox was the group that said, "No, we don't want to cut that knot. We don't want to turn Judaism into only a religion. We think that, or only nationality for that matter. We think that it needs to be that web of peoplehood and peoplehood and religion and tribe and culture and all of those things. Right? I'm not talking about today. Right? Today, I know that things across the board are a lot more complicated than that." But going back to some of the first principles, the point is that in most of the lands where Israeli Jews come from, there was never an orthodoxy because there was never a need for orthodoxy. There was Judaism, right? And there was always a toleration of, there was always a wide spectrum of observance, right? Some people observed, some people were observant, some people weren't observant, right? But Judaism was something that was understood to be one thing. It wasn't understood to be a choice of a multiplicity of things, right? It's only with, you know, the benefit of either the benefit of hindsight or the benefit of, you know, looking at things through a much broader historical lens that we can tell these people that lived in this shtetl, no, what you think of Judaism is only one thing of many, only one possibility of many, but it wasn't part of their experience, right? And so even when they came to Israel, it wasn't part of their experience, and the Jews who lived in Israel at the founding of the state, it was not part of their experience. So I think that to a certain extent, to a great extent, you can't really call what they observe, they wouldn't call it orthodox, right? It's through an American lens, you look at it and you say, that's orthodox. From an Israeli lens, they'll say, this isn't orthodox, this is Judaism, okay? And I think it's an important thing to like look at it through those different lenses. Meaning from their own experience, that's how they would define it. The word orthodox didn't enter the Israeli lexicon until the last 10 or 15 years. And even today, it's rarely used when describing people, right? The terms that you would use is, okay, you would have chiloni, which means secular. And you also have charedi, which, you know, is translated as ultra-orthodox, right? And then you have dati, which means religious, right? But that largely maps onto orthodoxy. Dati and orthodox are used as synonyms, right? And then you also have Chardal, which is ultra, right, nationalist, ultra-orthodox. And you also have Dati Light, which is orthodox, but kind of lax in observance. And then you have Datlash, which is Dati L'sheavar, which means formerly religious or formerly observant. I mean, you have all this, an infinite variety. Oh, and you also have Misorati, which is not, as opposed to Masorti, which is the conservative movement's name for itself in Israel, there was a more, I guess, small M, Misorati, which means traditional. Yeah, we'll light candles on Friday night, but then we'll drive to the beach in the morning. Meaning, like, we're somewhat observant of ritual and somewhat not observant of certain things, but we're traditional, okay? You have that very wide spectrum of observance. You have a very wide spectrum of identification, but the lexicon that's used in America is simply not used there. It's not, you know, and correctly so, because they're not looking at it as, meaning, I think it would be offensive, right? I would say that everybody in this room considers themselves on some level or another a religious Jew, right? Judaism is my religion, and there are certain things that I believe and certain things that I do and certain things that I espouse, certain values that I try to live by, that are part of my religion, right? And if you go to Israel, right, and people would say, wait, you're not religious. Like, what are you talking about? I am religious, right? I'm just not Orthodox. But that's, you know, for an Israeli, that would like, you know, he would short circuit. It's like, wait, I don't get it. I don't know what you're talking about, right? It's not part of his world. It's not part of his vocabulary, okay? It's starting to change, but it's starting to change slowly, and it's changing amongst the elites, amongst the people who are aware of what's going on in the diaspora or outside of Israel, and are aware of what's going on in the broader Jewish world. It hasn't percolated to the rank and file Israeli. Okay, where does that? I mean, there are other lenses that we can talk about. You know, I think that, you know, Israel is a nation state, a nation national religion. And I think that the United States is not a nation state, and it's a good thing that it's not a nation state. And the Americans have a hard time of relating to what it means to have a nation, to be a nation state. And I'm saying on the right and on the left, the Americans that are trying to, you know, promote a particular view of nationalism and think that America is a nation state, they also don't know what a nation state is, right? And I think it's important to call them out on that, because
meaning a nation state is a state like, you know, Hungary and the Czech Republic and Slovakia and Romania and Poland and Lithuania and Estonia and Latvia and Macedonia and Croatia and Slovenia. These are nation states. Yeah. Yeah. Like almost all European democracies are nation states, right? And what constitutes them as a nation, right, is the language that they speak, right, or the, you know, certain symbols, certain history, shared symbols, shared vocabulary, and oftentimes shared religion, right? And this was the problem, the Jewish problem throughout the 19th century was that are Jews part of our nation or not? Can Jews be part of the French nation? Can Jews be part of the Hungarian nation? Can Jews be part of the Polish nation? That was, you know, the question was answered with a finality in the 1940s, both with the Holocaust and with the establishment of a Jewish nation state, the Jewish nation state. Okay, but America is not, the United States of America is not a nation state. Right? Australia is not a nation state, and it's not really part of the American experience. So I think that that's also, I mean, so the idea of having a national religion. Right? America doesn't have a national religion. Again, there are people that are trying to turn back the clock on that, but there is no national religion in the United States of America, but that's not true of nation states. Nation states do have national religions, right? Where there might be toleration for other religions, but it is believed that, you know, in Hungary's constitution it mentions that it's a Christian nation. Maybe Hungary's not a great example considering what's going on there. There are other European nations wherein the religion is considered part and parcel of a certain nationality. Catholicism in Poland, it's part of being a Pole is being a Catholic. Another lens that we can look at this through is democracy that grew out of religion and democracy that grew out of a response to religion. In nations where democracy was anti-clerical, such as France, in order to achieve a sort of equilibrium, there were carve-outs for religious establishment. Like, okay, we're taking all the power away from the church. Okay, we're going to chuck you a couple of bones. Right, and that's sort of what happened in Israel. That's sort of what Israel is like today, but that's very much not the American model. 2 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about solutions, even though I think we're very far from solutions across the board. I think that this presentation, which I hope made some bit of sense, I think that it shows that in Israel, the direction to move in might not be to look towards James Madison style separation of church and state, building a high wall, but John Locke's toleration. Right, my own Rabbi Yehuda Amital, whose biography I translated, as you heard, you know, he espoused a view that said that we should institutionalize, we should have civil marriage, but we don't want to. He said, I don't want the state to recognize other denominations. Not because, you know, for the very simple reason that I don't think that it would turn it here too. It would turn Judaism into a religion. Once you say there's more than one path of Judaism, that means that there's more than one Judaism, and we believe that Judaism is, it's about peoplehood and about these other things also. That's what he believed. Okay, about. I'm not saying that it's impossible, meaning that it's impossible to have different groups that believe things that are very different, but still are part of the same people. But I think that's sort of view of okay, let's push for civil marriage, and under a civil marriage regime, right? If somebody wants to get married with a Reform rabbi, with a conservative rabbi, they'll be able to do that. It won't be illegal. So they'll be able to have that choice. They'll be able to make that choice, even if it wouldn't be even if we won't get to the Madisonian, right? Well, no rabbis are recognized as anything, right? We're getting to a state of toleration, but we're not getting to a state of all religions being treated equal under the law. but I think even before we talk about solutions, and I've got a whole bunch of different possibilities for solutions in mind, but we're not there yet. We're not the first thing that has to happen before we can learn. I think we have a lot to learn from each other, and I think that Americans and Israelis have a lot. American Jews and Israelis have a lot to learn from each other, and I think that, for example, I think that the way that American Jews build community, right, and I think we're sitting in an example of that here, building community is something that Israelis aren't good at, right? And marshaling religion in the cause of social justice. Israelis don't realize that Martin Luther King was a man of religion. Israelis they can't imagine. What do you mean, that guy? He was like a rabbi? He was a priest? He was a minister? They just can't, because religion is not associated with that sort of thinking, is not with that sort of cause. Religion is associated with, the guy that you go to rubber stamp your marriage. It's associated with repression. It's not associated with its opposite. And I think that's something that that Israel could desperately needs to learn from the United States, from the Judaism in the United States. And before we can learn from each other, I think that we need to learn a lot about each other. And so this is a beginning, right? What I'm trying to do here is a beginning. I apologize for making you my guinea pigs. This is the first time I've given this this talk. But
young lady over there.
Why do you want to make Israel another United States? I like the United States here. I don't think we have any business telling Israel what it should be. I don't get where it's in the Jewish news. It's everywhere you talk to people. They think that they should be able to tell Israel what they should do. Then it isn't Israel anymore. It's going to be not a Jewish state, and a Jewish state has the obligation to be a Jewish state. If it's Orthodox, fine. The Western civilization was founded on Orthodox Torah, not on Reform Torah, but look at what the Western world has become. It's a marvelous place. But it had a foundation, which was Judeo law.
I didn't realize we had different Torahs.
Yeah.
I understand what you're trying to say. I understand what you're trying to say.
The divorce rate in Israel?
I don't know offhand.
Well, that's a good thing to know. Especially if you're talking about marriage. And let me ask you one more question. When you have a consulate or an embassy, that's the United States embassy.
Mm-hmm.
You could get married at the embassy. That's American land in Israel.
Yeah, I think that that is a theoretical possibility. Meaning, for some reason, it's not done. Israelis go to Cyprus to get civil marriages, but I think that's a possibility. But let me. What's that?
We did one this summer with two of our Israeli shuhim that we worked with in the past that wanted to get married, and they came here to be married by us.
So they came to America, meaning they didn't get married in the embassy. Okay. First of all, I think if anybody wants to stay for questions, I'm happy to talk for as long as I'm happy to continue talking for as long as you want. But I do want to give the folks who have somewhere to be now a chance to go. So thank you very much for hearing me out. So I don't think, the basic question is, yes, you're right, Israel is a democracy.
We have a democracy, but that isn't what is over in Israel, and it shouldn't become the same thing where there will be no Jewish state.
Right. You know what?
I
think that at the end of the day, you're right, Israelis make decisions for what's best for Israel, but I think that, I'm saying, I'm an Israeli, and I think that Israel will be a better place. I'm an Israeli who grew up in America. But I think that Israel will be a better place if there are some things that we can learn from American Judaism. I agree with you that I don't think we want to go to American-style separation of church and state. I don't think it's possible to talk about a Jewish state and completely divorce the idea of Judaism from the religion of Judaism, right? Our calendar, our language, our calendar is a Jewish calendar, our language is a Jewish language, and I think our holidays are Jewish holidays, and it's impossible to divorce the religious element of those things from, from them, and if you do divorce them, if you say we're going to make a completely secular Passover, a completely cultural Purim, a completely, that our... Okay. I'm saying it's... I think that itself is taking a religious...
...carefully of what's going to happen in the long run. And if it takes away from having a Jewish
right.
state down the generations...
I don't think it would. I think that it's... I think that the Jewish state is a very robust state, It has a robust democracy. And I think we can afford to Israel can afford to look towards the United States and learn some things. Not learn everything, not completely import that model, but there are things that that can be learned. Yes, there was another question over here.
I moved.
Okay, you moved. Yes.
What's the impact of arts on women, the wall, and on the other side, lava? What's the impact on Israeli society and the way they view the fact that the state now is funding some Orthodox rabbis, some women, Reform rabbis?
Yeah. So I think that first of all, the state funding Orthodox rabbis. It's an interesting phenomenon because I think it's a good template for a lot of things. First of all, Modi'in, my city, was the first Israeli city to allocate land for the building, for the construction of a reform congregation, Kihilat Yozma. Okay, and I've communicated. I've exchanged emails with the rabbi, of the congregation, and I think it's a good thing, right? I think it's a good thing because I think it's an awareness that synagogues are not just synagogues. Synagogues are cultural spaces. Synagogues are, not just something that are part of the, belong in the ministry of religious affairs, but that it's something that, it's a much more valuable contribution, whether it's an Orthodox synagogue or a Reform synagogue, it's a much more valuable contribution to civic life, and I think that the city of Modi'in is, started to realize that. But it's the funding of reform rabbis, a little bit of the background. There's a kibbutz Gezer, was founded by Reform Jews, American Reform Jews, and they want, a kibbutz can, every kibbutz can elect its own rabbi, and they wanted to elect a Reform rabbi. The Ministry of Religious Affairs, who pays the salary, did not recognize, the Reform rabbi as a rabbi and said, well, we can't pay your salary. Sorry. So they worked out a compromise by which the position is funded, but the funding comes from the Ministry of Culture and not from the Ministry of Religion. Okay? Which is, it sounds so arcane and it sounds so Byzantine and bureaucratic, but I think it was an important step, and I think it's an important thing because on one hand, I want Kibbutz Gezer to make its own choices to choose the clergy person that it thinks will best represent its best satisfy its religious needs, right? I also understand that the way that Israelis think about Judaism, right, the Ministry of Religious Affairs, which governs the appointment of rabbis and the accreditation of rabbis, there's not enough of a constituency for them to start thinking about that. Maybe that we need to have a reform bureau within the Ministry of Religious Affairs. By the way,
if there is ever an establishment of a reform bureau in the ministry, in the Israeli Ministry of Religious Affairs, I can guarantee you it would be the worst thing to happen to the reform movement in Israel. Because I know that the worst thing that happened to Orthodoxy in Israel is the fact that somebody decided to make it, to put it in charge. It's terrible. So I think that this carve out, don't become part of the establishment. It's terrible. This carve out, I think, was a very important step because it created a compromise where, well, not perfect, it works. Yes.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to take Rabbi Fisher out of the building.
Thank you.
Okay.
I just wanted to compliment you. I learned so much about the intricacies in terms of the history of what you said and the problems of where government, where religion becomes like paralyzed into a government.
Yeah.
The only I just wanted to ask you, when you talked about Rabbi Holheim.